belonged with the McCulloughs. She is a McCullough, Fate insisted. Nor did the newspapers, which ran stories titled, Lawyer for Adoptive Parents Certain of Win. Mr. Richardson, however, was far less certain than the news stories made it sound. At dinner that evening, when Mrs. Richardson asked how the day's hearing had gone, he said little.
Linda testified today, he said. Ed Lynn was pretty hard on her. Didn't look good.
He meant for Mrs. McCullough. But as the words left his mouth, an idea occurred to him. A way to spin this. And later that evening, he would call his contacts at the paper. The following morning, the Plain Dealer would publish a story mentioning Ed Lim's aggressive tactics, how he had badgered poor Mrs. McCullough to the point of tears. Men like him, the article would suggest, weren't supposed to lose their cool, though it was never specified whether like him meant lawyers or something else entirely. But the truth was, as Mr. Richardson recognized, that an angry Asian man didn't fit the public's expectations, and was therefore unnerving. Asian men could be socially inept and incompetent and ridiculous, like a Long Duk Dong, or at best, unthreatening and slightly buffoonish, like a Jackie Chan. They were not allowed to be angry and articulate and powerful, and possibly right, Mr. Richardson thought uneasily. Once the article came out, a number of people who had been neutral threw their support behind the McCulloughs. Some who had been on Bibi's side found their passions cooling. For now, the idea still forming in his mind, he said only, "We'll see how things shake out." "I feel bad for her," Lexi said suddenly from the far end of the table. "Bibi, I mean. She must feel so awful."
"I'm sorry," said Izzy. "Is this the same Bibi that you referred to last month as a negligent mother?"
Lexi flushed.
"She should have taken better care of the baby," she admitted. "But I don't know. I wonder if she just got in over her head. If she didn't know what she was getting into.
And that's why pregnancy is not something to be taken lightly," Mrs. Richardson cut in.
"You hear me, Alexander Grace? Isabel Marie?"
She lifted the dish of green beans and helped herself to an almond-sprinkled spoonful. "Of course having a baby is difficult. It's life-changing. Clearly, Bibi wasn't ready for it, practically or emotionally. And that might be the best argument for giving the baby to Linda and Mark."
"So one mistake and that's it?" Lexi said. "I'm not ready to have a baby, but if I..."
She hesitated.
"If I got pregnant, you'd make me give it up too?"
"Lexi, that would never happen. We raised you to have more sense than that." Her mother set the dish back in the center of the table and speared a green bean with her fork.
"Well, somebody's heart grew 3 sizes today," Izzy said to Lexi. "What's with you?"
"Nothing," Lexi said. "I'm just saying. It's a complicated situation, that's all." She cleared her throat.
"Brian was saying that even his parents don't agree about it."
Moody rolled his eyes.
"The case that tore families all over Cleveland apart."
"John and Deborah are entitled to their own opinions," Mr. Richardson said, "as is everyone at this table." His gaze swept around the room.
"Trip, what's this I hear about a hat trick in yesterday's game?"
After dinner, however, Mr. Richardson's thoughts were still clouded.
"Do you think," he asked Mrs. Richardson as they cleared the table, "that Mark and Linda really know how to raise a Chinese child?"
Mrs. Richardson stared at him.
"It's just like raising any other child, I should think," she said stiffly, stacking the plates in the dishwasher. "Why on earth would it be any different?"
Mr. Richardson scrapped the remnants of egg noodles from the next plate into the disposal and handed it over.
"Of course, everything important is the same," he conceded. "But I mean, when that little girl gets older, she's going to have a lot of questions about who she is, where she came from. She's going to want to know about her heritage. Will they be able to teach her that? There are resources out there, Mrs. Richardson waved a dismissive hand, inadvertently flicking a few drops of stroganoff onto the counter. I don't see why they can't learn it alongside her. Wouldn't that bond them all closer, learning about Chinese culture together? She had vivid childhood memories of Linda swaddling her Raggedy Ann in an old kerchief and gently putting it to bed. More than anyone, she knew how fiercely Linda McCullough had always wanted a baby. How deep that longing to be a mother, that magical, marvelous, terrifying role, ran in her friend. Mia, she thought, ought to understand that better than anyone. Hadn't she seen that in the Ryans? Hadn't she maybe even felt it herself? Hadn't that been why she'd run away with Pearl? She swabbed at the counter with her thumb, smudging the granite. Honestly, I think this is a tremendous thing for Mirabel. She'll be raised in a home that truly doesn't see race, that doesn't care, not one infinitesimal bit, what she looks like. What could be better than that? Sometimes I think, she said fiercely, that we'd all be better off that way. Maybe at birth, everyone should be given to a family of another race to be raised. Maybe that would solve racism once and for all. She shut the dishwasher with a clang and left the room, the dishes inside still rattling in her wake. Mr. Richardson took a sponge and wiped the sticky counter clean. He should have known better than to bring it up, he realized. It was too personal for her. She couldn't see clearly. She was so close that she didn't even realize how unclearly she was seeing. For her, it was simple. Bibi Chow had been a poor mother. Linda McCullough had been a good one. One had followed the rules, and one had not. But the problem with rules, he reflected, was that they implied a right way and a wrong way to do things, when in fact most of the time there were simply ways, none of them quite wrong or quite right, and nothing to tell you for sure which side of the line you stood on. He had always admired his wife's idealism, her belief that the world could be made better, could be made orderly, could perhaps even be made perfect. For the first time, he wondered if the same held true for him. 17. It soon became clear, however, that Mr. Richardson was not the only conflicted party. The judge seemed to be waffling as well. A week passed after the hearing, then two, with no decision made. In mid-April, Lexi was due for a follow-up appointment at the clinic, and to both Pearl's and Mia's surprise, she asked Mia to accompany her. You don't have to do anything, she promised Mia. I'd just feel better if you were there. The earnestness in her voice was persuasive, and on the afternoon of the appointment after 10th period, Lexi parked her Explorer outside the house on Winslow. Mia started up the rabbit, and Lexi climbed into the passenger seat, and they drove away together. As if she really were Pearl. As if Mia really were her mother taking her on this most intimate errand. In fact, since the visit to the clinic, Pearl had felt a strange sense of reversal. As if, while she and Lexi slept under the same roof, Lexi had somehow taken her place, and she'd taken Lexi's, and they had not quite disentangled. Lexi had gone home in a borrowed T-shirt, and Pearl, watching her walk out the door in her own clothing, had had the eerie feeling of watching herself walk away. The next morning, she'd found Lexi's own shirt on her bed, laundered and carefully folded by Mia, presumably left there to be returned at school. Instead of tucking it into her bag, Pearl had put it on, and in this borrowed skin she'd felt prettier, wittier. Had even been a bit sassy in English class, to the amusement of her classmates and her teacher alike. When the bell rang, a few kids had glanced back at her, impressed, as if they were noticing her for the first time. So this is what it's like to be Lexi, she'd thought. Lexi herself was back at school. Wan and somewhat subdued and with dark rings under her eyes, but upright. You stole my shirt, bitch, she said to Pearl, but affectionately, and then... Looks good on you. Days later, shirt returned and her own retrieved, Pearl still felt Lexi's confidence fizzing in her veins. So now, when presented with a rare empty house, Pearl decided to take full advantage. She left a note in Tripp's locker. She told Moody that she'd promised to help her mother at home all afternoon. Mia, meanwhile, had told Izzy she had a shift at the restaurant. "Go do something fun," she'd said. "I'll see you tomorrow, okay?" So no one was home when Tripp and Pearl arrived at the house on Winslow after school and went upstairs to Pearl's bedroom. It was the first time Tripp had been to her house, and to her, it seemed momentous to be able to lie down with him in a place of her own choosing, instead of on the old, worn-out couch in Tim Michael's basement, surrounded by the PlayStation and the air hockey table and Tim's old soccer trophies, all the paraphernalia of someone else's life. This would be in her own space, in her own bed. And that morning, as she'd made it carefully, she'd felt a warm glow at the base of her throat, thinking of Tripp's head lying on her pillow. Moody, left to his own devices, had just shut his locker and was headed home when he heard someone calling his name. It was Tim Michaels, gym bag slung over his shoulder. Tim was tall and tough and had never been very kind to Moody. Years ago, when Tim and Tripp had been closer and he'd come over to the Richardsons now and then to play video games, he'd nicknamed Moody Jake.
"Jake, get me another Coke. Jake, move your big head. You're blocking my view."
Moody had dared to think it was affectionate, but then he'd heard it at school and understood what it meant in Shaker slang. Dave Matthews' band was Dope. Brian Adams was Jake. Getting to third base was Dope. Being grounded was Jake. After that, he'd stayed upstairs when Tim came over, and was meanly glad when he and Tripp began to drift apart. Now here was Tim calling Moody's name, his real name, and jogging down the theater wing toward him.
"Dude," Tim said when he'd caught up to Moody, "you know anything about this mystery girl of your brother's?"
It took Moody a moment to parse this question. "Mystery girl?"
"He's been bringing some girl over to my place in the afternoons while I'm at practice. Won't tell me who she is."
Tim shifted his gym bag to the other shoulder.
"Tripp's not really a man of mystery, you know what I mean? I figure either it's someone totally sketch, or he's really into her."
Moody paused. Tim was an idiot, but he wasn't imaginative. He wasn't the kind to make things up. A suspicion was beginning to form in his mind.
"You don't know anything about her?" he said. "Nothing. It's been like 2 months now. I'm almost tempted to go over there one afternoon and catch him in the act." "He hasn't said anything to you?"
"He never tells me anything," Moody said, and pushed the door open and went out onto the front lawn. He was still fretting when he got home and found Izzy reading on the couch.
"What are you doing home so early?" he said. "Mia had her other job this afternoon," Izzy said. She turned a page. "Where is everyone? Is Pearl not with you?"
Moody didn't answer. The suspicion was taking on an uncomfortable, solid shape.
"Some new project my mom's working on," Pearl had told him. "She just needs an extra set of hands."
Yet there was Izzy, a perfectly good set of extra hands, at home, telling him Mia was out. Without answering Izzy, he dropped his book bag on the coffee table and headed to the garage for his bike. All the way to the duplex on Winslow, he told himself he was imagining things, that there was nothing going on here, that this was all a coincidence. But there, just as he'd expected, was Tripp's car, parked across the street from the house. He stayed there, staring at Pearl's window for what felt like hours, trying not to think about what was happening inside, but unable to look away. It looked so innocent, that modest little brick house with its clean white door, the peach tree in the front yard ruffled with soft pink blossoms. When Tripp and Pearl emerged, they were holding hands, but that wasn't what shook him. There was an ease between them that Moody was sure could only come from being intimately comfortable with another person's body. The way their shoulders jostled as they came down the walkway. The way Pearl leaned over to close the zip on Tripp's backpack. The way he leaned down to smooth a stray curl out of her face. Then both of them looked up and saw Moody, astride his bicycle on the sidewalk, and froze. Before either of them could respond, he jammed his foot onto the pedal and sped away. It never occurred to Moody to confront his brother. This was only what he expected from Tripp. All of his fury was safe for Pearl, and later that afternoon, when she tiptoed upstairs and rapped on his door, he was not in the mood to listen to her excuses. "It just happened," she said, once she'd shut the door. Moody knew from her voice that she was telling the truth, but it brought him little comfort.
He rolled his eyes at how much she sounded like a character on a bad teen drama and went back to tuning his guitar.
Whatever, he said. I mean, if you want to screw my loser brother.
Pearl flinched, and in spite of himself, he stopped.
You know he's just using you, right?
He said after a moment.
That's what he does. He's never serious about anyone. He gets bored and he moves on.
Pearl maintained a defiant silence. This time, she was sure, was different. They were both right. Trip got bored easily and seldom thought about girls once they were out of his sight. But he had never encountered a girl like Pearl before, who wasn't embarrassed to be smart, who didn't quite fit into the orderly world of Shaker Heights, whether she knew it or not. Over the past 2 months, she had wormed into his mind at all hours of the day, in chemistry lab, during practice, at night when he normally would have fallen asleep quickly and dreamed banal dreams. The girls he'd grown up with in Shaker, and the boys too, for that matter, seemed so purposeful. They were so ambitious, they were so confident, they were so certain about everything. They were, he thought, a little like his sisters, and his mother. So convinced there was a right and a wrong to everything. So positive that they knew one from the other. Pearl was smarter than any of them, and yet she seemed comfortable with everything she didn't know. She lingered comfortably in the gray spaces. She thought about big things, he discovered, and in those afternoons after they'd been together, big things were what they ended up talking about. How bad he felt that he and Moody didn't get along.
We're brothers, he said. Aren't we supposed to be friends?
How he wasn't sure, at 17, what he wanted to do with his life. Everyone was asking. He was supposed to be thinking about college. He was supposed to know by now. And he didn't. Not at all.
There's time, Pearl had reassured him. There's always more time.
Being with Pearl made the world feel bigger, even as being with him made Pearl feel more grounded, less abstract, more real.
You're wrong about him, she said at last.
It's fine, Moody said.
I guess if you don't mind being the latest of his conquests.
I just thought you had more respect for yourself than that. If he looked up, he knew he would see the pain in Pearl's eyes. So he kept his eyes pointedly on the guitar in his lap.
I thought you were smarter than the sluts who usually agree to do it with him.
He thumbed one of the strings, nudged the tuning peg a little higher.
But I guess not.
At least there's someone who wants me. At least I'm not going to spend high school as a frustrated virgin. Pearl fought the urge to cross the room and yank the guitar from Moody's hands and smash it against the desk. And for your information, I'm not a conquest. You know what? I was the one who started it with him.
Moody had never seen Pearl angry before, and to his embarrassment, his first reaction was to burst into tears.
He didn't know what exactly he wanted to say. I'm sorry, I didn't mean it. Only the ever-deepening regret at how things were turning out between them. The desperate and impossible desire to go back to the way things had been. Instead, he bit the inside of his cheek to keep from crying, until the sharp, salty taste of blood spread over his tongue.
Whatever, he said at last. Just do me a favor and let's not talk about it, okay?
As it turned out, this meant they stopped talking at all. The following morning, they walked separately to school for the first time, took seats on the opposite sides of the classroom in first period and every period after that. More than anything, Moody told himself, he was disappointed in Pearl. That after all, she'd been shallow enough to pick Trip of all people. He hadn't expected her to choose him. Of course not. He, Moody, was not the kind of guy girls had crushes on. But Trip? That was unforgivable. He felt as if he'd dived into a deep, clear lake and discovered it was a shallow, knee-deep pond.
What did you do?
Well, you stood up. You rinsed your mud-cake knees and pulled your feet out of the muck. And you were more cautious after that. You knew from then on that the world was a smaller place than you'd expected. In the middle of algebra, when Pearl was in the bathroom and no one else was looking, he opened her book bag and pulled out the little black moleskin notebook he had given her all those months ago. As he'd suspected, the spine hadn't even been cracked, That evening, in the privacy of his room, he tore the pages out in handfuls, crushing them into wads and tossing them into the garbage can. When the can was heaped with crumpled paper, he dropped the leather cover, empty now, limp, like the husk stripped from an ear of corn, on top, and kicked the can under his desk. She never even noticed that it was missing. And somehow, this hurt him most of all.
Lexi, meanwhile, was having romantic troubles of her own. Since coming home from the clinic, she'd been understandably skittish about sleeping with Brian again, and the strain was starting to show. She said nothing to him about the abortion, and it sat between them like a scrim, blurring everything. Brian's patience was increasingly wearing thin.
"What's with you?" he grumbled one afternoon when he'd leaned over to kiss Lexi, and she had, once again, turned her face to offer her cheek instead. "You PMSing again?"
Lexi flushed.
"You guys, you think everything's about hormones. Hormones and periods. If men ever got periods, believe me, you'd all be in a ball on the ground from cramps."
"Look, if you're pissed at me, just tell me what it is you think I've done. I'm not a damn mind reader, Lex. I'm not going to apologize at random."
"Who says I wanted an apology?"
Lexi looked down at her hands, as if she might find a note scribbled on her palms, like a cheat sheet to guide her through.
"Who says I'm even pissed at you?"
"Well, if you're not pissed, why are you acting like this?"
"I just want some space, that's all. You don't have to be pawing me all the time."
"Space!" Brian slammed his hands against the steering wheel. "For the past month, I've given you nothing but space. You haven't even kissed me in like a week. How much more space do you need?"
"Maybe all of it." The words fell out of Lexi's mouth like stones. "I'm going off to Yale, and you're heading to Princeton. Maybe it's better this way."
Stunned silence filled the car as Lexi and Brian both picked over what she'd said.
"That's what you want?" Brian said at last.
"Okay. We're done then."
He clicked the unlock button on the car door.
"See you around."
Lexi slung her book bag over her shoulder and stepped out of the car. They had been parked on a quiet side street, a spot they'd used often when they wanted time alone. He wouldn't just drive off, she thought to herself. This can't really be how it ends. But as soon as she slammed the door shut, Brian started the car with a growl and drove away. He didn't look back, though Lexi thought she saw his eyes flick to the rearview mirror just once before he turned the corner. Without thinking where she was going, she began to walk, down the sidewalk and around the corner and out to the main road, paths she'd driven often but seldom walked before. She and Brian had been friends since the eighth grade, had been dating for almost 2 years. She thought of everything they'd done together, screaming from way up in the bleachers at Indians games, watching from the middle school parking lot on the 4th of July as the city shot fireworks high into the night sky. Homecoming, Brian slipping a rose corsage onto her wrist, an Italian dinner at Giovanni's neither of them knew how to pronounce, dancing in the gym to the Fugees until they were both beaded with sweat, then pressed in his arms during "I Don't Want to Miss a Thing," so close that their sweat mingled. Now all that was gone. She walked and walked, following the curve of the road, stopping now and then only to let cars pass by. And then she found her feet had taken her somewhere she hadn't expected, but that felt like the only place in the world she wanted to be. Not home, but the duplex on Winslow. Through the upstairs window, she could see Mia hard at work on something, and Lexi knew that Mia would know just the right thing to say, would give her the space to think this through, to process what had just happened. What would happen next? Why'd she just left what she thought was a perfect boyfriend, a perfect relationship? How it had all suddenly fallen apart. When Lexi climbed the stairs and opened the door into the kitchen, Izzy was there too, sitting at the table beside Mia, folding scraps of paper into cranes. Handfuls of them in all sizes lay on the table already, scattered across it like confetti. She shot Lexi a hostile look, but before she could open her mouth, Mia cut her off. "Lexi, I'm glad you came." She pulled out a chair and Lexi settled into it, her face so still that even Izzy could tell something was wrong. Lexi looked almost as if she were going to be physically ill. She had never seen her sister like this before.
"Are you okay?"
she asked.
"Fine,"
Lexi said through dry lips.
"I'm fine."
"You're fine," Mia said, squeezing Lexi's shoulder. "You're going to be fine." She pulled an extra mug from the cupboard and put the kettle on. Without meeting Izzy's eyes, Lexi said,
"Before you ask, Brian and I broke up."
"I'm sorry," Izzy said, and found that she really meant it. Brian had always been nice to her, letting her tag along for milkshakes once or twice at Yours Truly when he and Lexi had first started dating and she'd been in middle school, giving her a ride home now and then when he'd passed her walking. She glanced at Lexi, then at Mia.
"Do you want me to leave?"
At the stove, Mia pretended to busy herself with opening a tea bag. Lexi shook her head.
"Stay,"
she said.
"It's fine. I'm fine. Just stay."
After a moment, Izzy slid a square of paper across the table, and Lexi took it and began to follow her sister's lead, folding over, back, to the center, out, until at last she took hold of the corners and pulled. And a crane bloomed like a pale flower in her hands.
"Judge Reinbeck says he's not yet ready to make a decision," Mr. Richardson told Mrs. Richardson the last week of April. Harold Reinbeck was 69, gray-haired, a longtime boxing fan, and an enthusiastic recreational hunter. But he was a sensitive man, too, and well aware of the intricate emotional complexities of the case. Over the past month since the hearing had ended, he had, in fact, spent nights lying awake for hours thinking about little Mei Ling Mirabel, as he thought of her, trying to be scrupulously fair. Every time he heard one name, he appended the other in his mind. And for him, the two names had firmly blended into one. Because the baby herself was in the care of a sitter and not present, infants being notoriously indisposed to long hearings, Ed Lim had wisely blown up a photograph and placed it on his prep table, and everyone in the court had been staring at it every day. As a result, the judge pictured her small face as he mulled over each day's testimony, and the more he thought about it, the more undecidable the case became. He felt a sudden, intense sympathy for King Solomon, and each morning, short on sleep and uncomfortable in mind, he barked unfairly at his clerks and his secretary without even realizing why. "It's agony," Mrs. McCullough said to Mrs. Richardson over a commiserating cup of coffee. They were, as usual, in Mrs. McCullough's home to avoid scrutiny. "What else does he want? How can this be a hard decision?" The baby monitor on the table beside them crackled, and she adjusted the volume slightly higher. Both women fell silent, and the quiet sound of Mirabel's sleeping breathing filled the kitchen.
"Can you think of anything else you could tell the judge?" Mrs. Richardson asked. "Things that give more context. Other factors for him to weigh."
She leaned forward.
"Can you think of anything else you and Bill haven't brought up? Reasons you'd be the better choice for custody?" Or,
she hesitated,
then plunged in anyway.
"Or other reasons Bibi might be unfit. Anything at all."
Mrs. McCullough nibbled one fingernail. It had been her nervous habit as a child, and Mrs. Richardson noticed she'd been doing it again of late.
"Well," she began, then stopped.
"It's probably not true."
"This might be your last chance, Linda," Mrs. Richardson said gently.
"Anything you've got,
we'd better throw at them."
"It's only a suspicion. I don't have any proof,"
Mrs. McCullough sighed.
"About 3 months ago, I noticed that Bibi seemed plumper. Her face got rounder and rounder. I noticed that particularly when she came with the social worker to pick up Mirabel. And her chest. And the social worker told me something strange. She said that on one of their visits around then, Bibi had to run off to the bathroom suddenly. They were at the library, and she suddenly handed Adrienne the baby and dashed off. Adrienne said she heard Bibi throwing up."
Mrs. McCullough looked up at Mrs. Richardson.
"It just made me wonder if she might have been pregnant. She seemed so incredibly exhausted then, too,
I just had this hunch. There's a look women get. You can see it if you look. All these years, all this time we were trying, and one after another of my friends got pregnant. Every time. I knew before they told me. But I knew every time you were pregnant, didn't I, Elena?
You did, said Mrs. Richardson.
Every time you knew, before I'd said a word.
And then, about a month ago, she suddenly went back to normal. Her face flattened out again, back to being skinny and straight as a rail. I wondered...
Mrs. McCullough took a deep breath.
I wondered if she might have been pregnant, and then ended it.
An abortion. Mrs. Richardson settled back in her chair. That's a big accusation.
I'm not accusing, Mrs. McCullough insisted. I told you I don't have proof. Only a suspicion.
And you said anything.
She sipped her coffee, which had gone cold.
If she had had an abortion, would that change anything?
Maybe, Mrs. Richardson considered.
Having an abortion doesn't make her a bad mother, of course. Though it would likely turn public opinion against her if the news got out.
People don't like to hear about abortions.
And an abortion while trying to get back a baby you abandoned?
She drummed her fingers on the table.
At the very least, it would suggest that she was careless enough to get pregnant again.
She took Mrs. McCullough's hand and squeezed it. I'll look into it. See if there's anything that might help.
If there is, we can bring it up with the judge.
Elena, Mrs. McCullough sighed.
You always know what to do. What on earth would I do without you? Don't say anything to Bill or Mark, Mrs. Richardson said, gathering her purse. Let's not get their hopes up yet. Trust me, I'll take care of everything.
Phoebe had not, in fact, been pregnant.
Under the stress of the impeding hearing, with news crews filming outside the restaurant one day and a journalist stopping her on the street to shove a microphone in her face the next, with a story about the case out every day, it felt like, and her boss grumbling about the time she'd have to take off for the hearing, she had given in to junk food cravings. Oreos, French fries, once an entire bag of pork rinds, ballooning up 15 pounds in a month. She'd put in extra hours to make up for the time she'd be taking off, working until 2 or 3 on the nights she closed and arriving at 9 to open the next morning. That time, in her memory, existed only as a blur. And then she'd gotten food poisoning. A box of leftovers that had sat too long in the fridge and thrown up right in the library, in front of the social worker. She hadn't been able to eat for days afterward. And when she recovered, she found that, with the hearing mere weeks away, she was too nervous to eat. By the time the hearing began, she had lost the extra 15 pounds, plus 10 more. Mrs. Richardson, however, knew none of this. With no way to prove a negative, she began, logically enough, by searching for evidence of the positive. She could find anything out, she reminded herself. Even if she didn't know it herself, she had connections. The next morning, she pulled out her Rolodex and flipped to the M's. Manuel. Elizabeth. She and Elizabeth Manuel had been roommates freshman year in college, and though they'd found other roommates in later years, they'd stayed in touch, through graduation and afterward. They had reconnected when Elizabeth moved to Cleveland and became the head of a medical clinic just east of Shaker Heights. The only clinic on the east side, it happened, that provided abortions. It was a small thing, Mrs. Richardson wanted to ask. A small, illicit, slightly illegal thing. Could she check the clinic's records and see if Bibi Chow's name appeared in the list of recent abortions? Unofficially, off the record, Mrs. Richardson assured her friend, tucking the phone receiver against her shoulder and double-checking that her office door was shut.
Elena, Elizabeth Manuel said, shutting her own office door, you know I can't do that.
It doesn't have to be a big thing. No one needs to know.
It's confidential.
Do you know how much the fines are for that, not to mention the ethics of it? Elizabeth Manuel had been friends with Mrs. Richardson for many years, and she owed Mrs. Richardson a great deal, though she herself hated to put it that way. She had shown up at Denison as Betsy, a painfully shy girl from Dayton, relieved to escape the constant teasing that had been her high school years, terrified that college might turn out to be the same. At 18, Elizabeth Manuel was an easy target for mockery. Glasses perpetually sliding down her nose, forehead knobby with acne,
clothes frumpy and ill-fitting. Her new roommate looked just like the snotty girls who had made high school miserable. Pretty, beautifully dressed, somehow at ease with the world. And that first night, she had cried herself to sleep. But Elena had taken her under her wing and transformed her. She'd lent her lipstick and Noxzema, taken her shopping, taught her new ways to style her hair. Walking to class with Elena, sitting beside her in the dining hall, Elizabeth had learned a new confidence as well. She began to speak as Elena did, as if she knew people wanted to hear her thoughts, and to hold herself taller, like a dancer. By the time they graduated, Elizabeth was a different person. Liz Manuel, who wore pantsuits and heels and architect's glasses that made her look almost as smart as she was. A person who would go on to run a clinic with ease. In the years that followed, Elena, now Mrs. Richardson, had continued to offer her assistance. With her many local connections, she had put in a good word when Elizabeth had applied to the clinic, and after Elizabeth had gotten the job and moved to town, had introduced her to all sorts of people, both professionally and personally. In fact, Elizabeth had met her husband at a cocktail party the Richardsons had thrown some years before. He had been a colleague of Mr. Richardson's. Mrs. Richardson had never asked, or even hinted, at repayment, and both of them were keenly aware of this. "How is Derek, by the way?" Mrs. Richardson asked suddenly. "And Mackenzie?" "They're fine, both of them. Derek's been working too hard, of course." "I can't believe Mackenzie's 10 already," Mrs. Richardson mused. "How is she fitting in at Laurel?"
"She loves it. She seems so much more confident now. I think it makes a real difference being at a girls' school, you know?"
Elizabeth Manuel paused. "Thanks again for putting a word in."
"Betsy, don't be ridiculous. It was my pleasure." Mrs. Richardson tapped her pen against her desktop. "What are friends for?"
"You understand, Elena. I'd love to help you. It's just if anyone found out..."
"Of course you can't show me anything. Of course not.
But I mean, if I were to come and take you for lunch, and I just happened to glance over your shoulder at the list for the past few months, no one could possibly say you had shown me on purpose, could they?"
"And what if this woman's name is on there?" Elizabeth asked.
"What good does it do? Bill can't use it in court. If it does, he'll look for other evidence. I know it's a huge favor, Betsy. He just needs to know if it's even worth digging. And if it's not, this goes no further."
Elizabeth Manuel sighed. "All right," she said at last. "I'm tied up the next few days, but how about Thursday?" The two women scheduled a lunch date, and Mrs. Richardson hung up the phone. She would soon have this cleared up. Poor woman, she thought, thinking of Bibi with new generosity. If she had had an abortion, who could blame her? In the middle of this custody case with only a dead-end job, and after what she'd been through with the first. No one had an abortion without regret, she thought. Abortions were an action of last resort, when there was no better option. No, Mrs. Richardson could not blame Bibi, even as she still hoped the McCulloughs kept the baby.
"But she can always have another," Mrs. Richardson thought, "once she gets her life together."
And she propped her office door open again. 18. Mrs. Richardson's benevolent mood toward Bibi lasted until her lunch date with Elizabeth Manuel.
"Betsy," she said as she was buzzed into the office on Thursday, "it's been way too long. When did we last get together?"
"I can't remember. Holiday party last year, maybe."
"How are the kids?"
Mrs. Richardson took a moment to brag. "Lexi's plans for Yale, Tripp's latest lacrosse game, Moody's good grades." As usual, she glossed over the topic of Izzy, but Elizabeth didn't notice. Until that very moment, she had planned to help Elena. Elena had done so much for her, after all. And anyway, Elena Richardson never stopped until she got what she wanted. She had even gone so far as to pull up the records Elena had asked for, a list of all the patients in the past few months who'd had a procedure at the clinic. They were in a separate window on her screen, behind a budgeting spreadsheet. But now, as Elena prattled on about her marvelous children, her husband's high-profile case, the new landscaping they planned to do in the backyard once the summer came. Elizabeth changed her mind. She had forgotten, until they were face to face, how Elena so often talked to her as if she were a child. As if she, Elena, were the expert in everything and Elizabeth should be taking notes. Well, she wasn't a child. This was her office, her clinic. Out of habit, she'd picked up a pen at the sight of Elena, and now she set it down. "It'll be strange having just the three of them in the house next year," Mrs. Richardson was saying. "And of course Bill is so frazzled about this case. You remember Linda and Mark from some of our parties, no? Linda recommended that dog sitter for you a couple years back. We're all hoping it's over soon and that they get to keep their baby for good." Elizabeth stood up. "Ready for lunch?" she said, reaching for her handbag. But Mrs. Richardson did not move from her seat. "There was that one thing I wanted your advice on, Betsy," she said. "Remember?" With one hand, she pushed the door shut. Elizabeth sat down again and sighed, as if Elena could have forgotten what she wanted. "Elena," she said, "I'm sorry. I can't." "Betsy," Mrs. Richardson said quietly, "one quick glance. That's all. Just to know if there's even anything to find out. It's not that I don't want to help you. I would never put you at any risk. I'd never use this information. This is just to see if we need to keep digging. I would love to help you, Elena, but I've been thinking it over, and, Betsy, how many times have we stuck our necks out for each other? How much have we done for one another?" Betsy Manuel, Mrs. Richardson thought, had always been timid. She'd always needed a good push to do anything, even things she wanted to do. You had to give her permission for every little thing, to wear lipstick, to buy a pretty dress, to put her hand up in class. Wishy-washy. She needed a firm hand. "This is confidential information." Elizabeth sat up a bit straighter. "I'm sorry." "Betsy, I have to admit I'm hurt. That after all these years of friendship, you don't trust me?" "It's not about trust," Elizabeth began, but Mrs. Richardson went on as if she hadn't been interrupted. After all she'd done for Betsy, she thought. She'd nurtured her like a mother and coaxed her out of her shell, and here was Betsy now, at her big desk in her posh office at the job Elena had helped her get, not even willing to grant her a little favor. She opened her purse and drew out a gold tube of lipstick and a palm-sized mirror. "Well, you trusted my advice all through college, didn't you? And when I told you you should come to our Christmas party all those years ago? You trusted me when I told you that you should call Derek instead of waiting for him to call you? And you were engaged, what, by Valentine's Day?" With small, precise strokes, she traced the contours of her mouth and clicked the tube shut. "You got a husband and a child by trusting me. So I'd say trusting my judgment has worked out well for you every time before." It confirmed something Elizabeth had long suspected. All these years, Elena had been building up credit. Perhaps she'd honestly wanted to help. Perhaps she'd been motivated by kindness. But even so, she'd been keeping a running tally of everything she'd ever done for Elizabeth, too. Every bit of support she'd given. And now she expected to be repaid. Elena thought she was owed this, Elizabeth realized suddenly. She thought it was a question of fairness, about getting what she deserved under the rules. "I hope you aren't planning to take credit for my entire marriage," she said, and Mrs. Richardson was taken aback at the sharpness in her voice. "Of course I didn't mean that," she began. "You know that I'll always help you any way I can, but there are laws and ethics, Elena. I'm disappointed that you would even ask for such a thing. You've always been so concerned with what's right and wrong." Their eyes met across the desk, and Mrs. Richardson had never seen Betsy's gaze so clear and steady and fierce. Neither of them spoke, and in that pocket of silence, the phone on the desk rang. Elizabeth held the stare for a moment more and then lifted the receiver. "Elizabeth Manuel?" A faint murmur from the other end of the line. "You just caught me. I was about to step out for lunch." More murmuring. To Mrs. Richardson's ears, it sounded vaguely apologetic. "Eric, I don't need excuses. I just need this done." "No, I've been waiting for this over a week. I don't want it to wait another minute.
Look, I'll be right down. Elizabeth hung up and turned to Mrs. Richardson. I have to run downstairs. There's a report I've been expecting, and I've had to nudge it along every step of the way. One of the delightful parts of being the director. She stood up. I'll just be a few minutes. And when I get back, we'll go for lunch. I'm starving, and I've got a meeting at 1:30. When she had gone, Mrs. Richardson sat stunned. Had that really been Betsy Manuel talking to her like that? Implying that she was unethical. And that last little dig about being the director. As if Betsy were reminding her how important she was. As if to say, I'm more important than you now. When she'd helped Betsy get this very job. Mrs. Richardson pressed her lips together. The door to the office had been pushed to. No one outside could see in. Quickly, she came around the desk to Elizabeth's chair and nudged the mouse across its pad, and the black screen of Elizabeth's monitor flickered to life. A spreadsheet showing the year-to-date expenses. Mrs. Richardson paused. Surely the clinic had some kind of database of patient records. With a click, she shrank the spreadsheet, and like magic, there it was. A window listing the patients in just the period she'd wanted. So Betsy had changed her mind at the last minute, she thought with a flash of smugness. What had she always said? Wishy-washy. Mrs. Richardson leaned over the desktop and scrolled quickly through the list. There was no Bibi Chow, but a name at the bottom of the list, in early March, caught Mrs. Richardson's attention. Pearl Warren. 6 minutes later, Elizabeth Manuel returned to find Mrs. Richardson back in her own seat, composed and unruffled except for one hand clenched on the arm of the chair. She had reopened the budget spreadsheet and put the monitor back to sleep, and when Elizabeth sat down again at her desk that afternoon, she would notice nothing amiss. She would close the list with relief, proud of herself for standing up to Eleanor Richardson at last. Ready for lunch, Eleanor? Over Saag Paneer and chicken tikka masala, Mrs. Richardson put her hand on Elizabeth's arm. We've been friends a long time, Betsy. I'd hate to think something like this would come between us. I hope it goes without saying that I understand completely, and I'd never hold this against you. Of course not, Elizabeth said, stabbing a piece of chicken with her fork. Since they'd left her office, Eleanor had been stiff and a bit cool. Eleanor Richardson had always been like this, she thought, charming and generous and always saying kind things. And then, when she wanted something, she was sure you couldn't say no. Well, she had done the impossible. She had said no. Is Lexi still doing theater? She asked. And for the rest of the meal, they made superficial chit-chat about the common denominators of their life. Children, traffic, the weather. This would, in fact, be the last lunch the two women ever had together, though they would remain cordial to each other for the rest of their lives. So, innocent little Pearl was not so innocent after all, Mrs. Richardson thought on her way back to the office. There was no doubt in her mind who the father was, of course. She had long suspected Pearl and Moody's relationship was more than friendly. A boy and a girl didn't spend so much time together at their age without something happening. And she was appalled. How could they have been so careless? She knew how much emphasis Shaker placed on sex ed. She had sat on the school board committee 2 years before when a parent complained that her daughter had been asked to put a condom on a banana during health class, for practice. Teens are going to have sex, Mrs. Richardson had said then. It's the age. It's the hormones. We can't prevent it. The best thing we can do is teach them to be safe about it. Now, however, that view seemed wildly naive. How could they have been so irresponsible, she wondered. More pressing, how had they managed to keep this from her? How could it have happened right under her very nose? For a moment, she considered going to the school, pulling the two of them out of class, demanding how they could have been so stupid. Better not to make a scene, she decided. Everyone would know. Girls in Shaker, she was sure, had abortions now and then. They were teenagers, after all. But of course it was all kept very quiet. No one wanted to broadcast their failures in responsibility. Everyone would talk, and she knew how rumors would fly. That was the kind of thing she knew that stuck to a girl. It would tar you for life. She would speak to Moody that evening as soon as she got home, Back at her office, she had just taken off her coat when the phone rang.
"Bill," she said. "What's going on?"
Mr. Richardson's voice was muffled, and there was a lot of commotion in the background.
"Judge Reinbeck just delivered his decision. He called us in an hour ago. We didn't expect it at all."
He cleared his throat.
"She's staying with Mark and Linda. We won."
Mrs. Richardson sank into her chair. Linda must be so happy, she thought. At the same time, a thin snake of disappointment wriggled its way through her chest. She had been looking forward to ferreting out Phoebe's past, to delivering the secret weapon that would end things for good. But she hadn't been needed after all.
"That's wonderful." "They're beside themselves with joy. Phoebe Chow took it hard, though. Burst out screaming. The bailiff had to escort her outside."
He paused.
"Poor woman. I can't help but feel bad for her."
"She gave up the baby in the first place," Mrs. Richardson said. It was exactly what she'd been saying for the past 6 months, but this time it sounded less convincing. She cleared her throat. "Where are Mark and Linda?"
"They're getting ready for a press conference. The news team's got wind of it and have been showing up left and right, so we said we'd make a statement at 3. So I'd better go."
Mr. Richardson let out a deep sigh.
"But it's done. She's theirs now. They just have to hold out until the story dies down and they can all go back to living their lives."
"Well, that's wonderful," Mrs. Richardson said again.
The news about Pearl and Moody settled on her shoulders like a heavy bag, and she wanted badly to blurt it out to her husband, to share some of its weight, but she pushed it away. This was not the moment, she told herself. Firmly, she put Moody out of her mind. This was a moment to celebrate with Linda.
"I'll come down to the courthouse," she said. 3 o'clock, you said?"
Across town in the little house on Winslow, Phoebe was crying at Mia's kitchen table. As soon as the verdict had been announced, she'd heard a terrible keening, so sharp she'd clamped her hands over her ears and collapsed into a ball. Only when the bailiff took her arm to escort her out of the room did she realize that the wail was coming from her own mouth. The bailiff, who had a daughter about Phoebe's age, took her to an anteroom and pressed a cup of lukewarm coffee into her hands. Phoebe had swallowed it, mouthful by watery mouthful, digging her teeth into the styrofoam rim every time she felt a scream rising in her throat again. And by the time the coffee was gone, the cup had been shredded almost to pieces. She did not even have words, only a feeling, a terrible, hollow feeling, as if everything inside her had been scooped out raw. When she had finished the coffee and calmed down, the bailiff gently pried the shards of foam from her hands and threw them away. Then he led her out a back entrance, where a cab was waiting. "Take her wherever she wants," he told the driver, passing him 2 twenties from his own wallet. To Phoebe, he said, "You're gonna be okay, honey. You're gonna be fine. God works in mysterious ways. You keep your chin up." He shut the cab door and headed back inside, shaking his head. In this way, Phoebe was able to avoid all the news cameras and crews that had lined up at the front entrance, the news conference that the McCulloughs were preparing for that afternoon, the reporters who had hoped to ask her whether, in the light of this decision, she would try to have another child. Instead, Edlam deflected their questions, and the cab sped away up Stokes Boulevard toward Shaker Heights, and Phoebe slumped against the window with her head in her hands, also missed a last glimpse of her daughter. Carried down the hallway from the waiting room by a DCF social worker and placed into Mrs. McCullough's waiting arms. 45 minutes later, there had been traffic. The cab pulled up in front of the little house on Winslow. Mia was still home, trying to finish a piece she'd been working on, and she took one look at Phoebe and understood what had happened. She would get the details later, some from Phoebe herself when she'd calmed down, others from the news stories that would air that night and the newspaper articles that would print the next morning. Full custody to the state, with a recommendation that the adoption by the McCulloughs be expedited. Termination of visitation rights. A court order prohibiting further contact between Phoebe and her daughter without the McCulloughs' unlikely consent.
For now, she simply folded Bibi in her arms and took her into the kitchen, set a cup of hot tea before her, and let her cry. The news was just beginning to spread at the high school as the last bell rang. Monique Lim got a page from her father. Sarah Hendricks, whose father worked at Channel 5, got another from hers, and word traveled from there. Izzy, however, knew nothing of this until she arrived at Mia's after school, let herself in through the unlocked side door as usual, and came upstairs to see Bibi crumpled at the kitchen table. "What happened?" she whispered, though she already knew. She had never seen an adult cry like that, with such an animal sound, recklessly, as if there were nothing more to be lost. For years afterward, she would sometimes wake in the night, heart-thumping, thinking she'd heard that agonized cry again. Mia jumped up and shepherded Izzy back out onto the stairs, shutting the kitchen door behind her. "Is she dying?" Izzy whispered. It was a ridiculous question, but in that moment she was honestly terrified this might be true. If a soul could leave a body, she thought, this is the sound it would make, like the screech of a nail being pulled from old wood. Instinctively, she huddled against Mia and buried her face against her. "She's not dying," Mia said. She put her arms around Izzy and held her close.
"But is she going to be okay?"
"She's going to survive, if that's what you mean." Mia stroked Izzy's hair, which billowed out from beneath her fingers like plumes of smoke. It was like pearls, like her own had been as a little girl. The more you tried to smooth it, the more it insisted on springing free. "She's going to get through this, because she has to."
"But how?" Izzy could not believe that someone could endure this kind of pain and survive.
"I don't know, honestly. But she will. Sometimes, just when you think everything's gone, you find a way." Mia racked her mind for an explanation. "Like after a prairie fire. I saw one years ago when we were in Nebraska. Seems like the end of the world. The earth is all scorched and black and everything green is gone. But after the burning, the soil is richer and new things can grow." She held Izzy at arm's length, wiped her cheek with a fingertip, smoothed her hair one last time. "People are like that too, you know. They start over. They find a way." Izzy nodded and turned to go, then turned back.
"Tell her I'm so sorry," she said.
Mia nodded. "See you tomorrow, okay?" Lexi and Moody, meanwhile, came home to a message on the answering machine telling them the case was over. "Order some pizza," their mother's staticky voice said. "There's cash in the drawer under the phone book. I'll be home after I file my piece. Dad won't be home until late. He's tying up paperwork after the hearing." Did Pearl know yet? Moody wondered. But they'd barely spoken since their falling out, and he retreated to his room and did his best not to wonder what Pearl was doing. As he'd guessed, Pearl was out with Tripp that afternoon and learned the news only when she came home some hours later to find Bibi, quiet now, still at the kitchen table. "It's over," Mia told her quietly. And that was all that needed to be said. "I'm really sorry, Bibi," Pearl said. I'm so sorry." Bibi didn't even look up, and Pearl disappeared into her bedroom and shut the door behind her. Mia and Bibi sat in silence for some time, until it had grown quite dark and Bibi finally rose to go. "She will always be your child," Mia said to Bibi, taking her hand. "You will always be her mother. Nothing will ever change that." She kissed Bibi on the cheek and let her go. Bibi said nothing, just as she had said nothing all this time, and Mia wondered if she should ask what she was thinking, if she should push her to stay, if Bibi would be all right. In her place, she thought, she'd rather not be forced to talk, and tacked one out. Later, she would realize that Bibi must have heard this differently. That she must have heard, in these words, a permission granted. She would wonder if Bibi might have told her what she was planning if she'd pushed harder, and whether she would have tried to stop Bibi, or if she'd have helped if she'd known. Even years later, she would never be able to answer this question to her own satisfaction. The press conference ran longer than expected. Nearly every news outfit had questions for the McCulloughs, and the McCulloughs, dazzled by their good fortune, stayed to answer them all. Were they relieved to have the ordeal over? Yes, of course they were. What were their plans for the next few days? They would take some time to themselves now that Mirabel was home to stay. They were looking forward to their life together as a family. What were they going to make for Mirabel's first meal back home? Mrs. McCullough answered, macaroni and cheese, her favorite. When would the adoption process be finalized? Very soon, they hoped. A reporter from Channel 19 at the back of the crowd raised her hand. Did they feel any sympathy for Bibi Chow, who would never get to see her daughter again? Mrs. McCullough stiffened. Let's remember, she said sharply, that Bibi Chow wasn't able to care for Mirabel, that she abandoned her, that she walked away from her responsibilities as a mother. Of course, it saddens me that anyone would have to go through such a thing, but the important thing to remember is that the court decided Mark and I are the most appropriate parents for Mirabel, and that now Mirabel will have a stable, permanent home. I think that speaks volumes, don't you? By the time the conference had wound down and the McCulloughs had taken Mirabel home for good, it was almost 5:30. Mrs. Richardson, due to her husband's involvement in the case, could not write the Sun Press's story on the decision, so Sam Levy had been assigned the story instead. In his place, Mrs. Richardson was to cover Sam's usual beat, city politics. It was nearly 9 o'clock when Mrs. Richardson finally filed her stories and arrived home. Her children had scattered to their own devices. Lexi's and Tripp's cars were gone, and on the counter, Mrs. Richardson found a note. Mom, went to Serena's. Back, 11. L. No note from Tripp, but that was typical. Tripp never remembered to leave notes. Ordinarily, this was a source of annoyance, but this time Mrs. Richardson found herself relieved. With so many people in the Richardson house, there was usually an audience, and tonight she did not want an audience. Upstairs, she found Izzy's door shut, music wailing from inside. She had gone upstairs even before the pizza had arrived, and had been in her room since, thinking about Bibi. How utterly shattered she had seemed. Part of her wanted to scream, so she slid a Tori Amos CD into the player, turned up the volume, and let it do the screaming for her. And part of her wanted to cry, though she never cried, hadn't cried in years. She lay in the center of her bed and dug her fingernails into her palms so hard they left a row of half-moons to keep tears from falling. By the time her mother came past her doorway and down the hall, toward Moody's room, she had listened to the album 4 times and was just beginning on the 5th. On an ordinary day, Mrs. Richardson would have opened the door, told Izzy to turn the volume down, made some disparaging comments about how depressing and angry Izzy's music always seemed to be. Today, however, she had more important things on her mind. Instead, she went down the hallway to Moody's room and rapped on the door. "I need to talk to you," she said. Moody was sprawled on his bed, guitar beside him, scribbling in a notebook. "What?" he said without looking up. He didn't bother to sit up as his mother entered, which irritated her further. She shut the door and marched to the bed and yanked the notebook out of his hands. "You look at me when I'm talking to you," she said. "I found out, you know. Did you think I wouldn't?" Moody stared. "Found out what?" "Did you think I was blind? Did you think I wouldn't even notice?" Mrs. Richardson slammed the notebook shut. "The two of you sneaking around all the time. I'm not stupid, Moody. Of course I knew what you were up to. I just thought you'd be a little more responsible." In Izzy's room, the music clicked off, but neither Moody nor his mother noticed. Moody slowly pushed himself up to a sitting position. "What are you talking about?" "I know," Mrs. Richardson said. "About Pearl? About the baby?" The shock on Moody's face, his stunned silence, told her everything. He hadn't known, she realized. "She didn't tell you?" Moody's gaze had unfocused slowly from her face like a boat adrift. "She didn't tell you," Mrs. Richardson said, sinking down on the bed beside him. "Pearl had an abortion." She felt a pang of guilt. Would things have been different, she wondered, if he had known? When Moody still said nothing, Mrs. Richardson leaned over to take his hand. I thought you knew, she said. I assumed you talked it over and decided to end it. Moody slowly, coldly, pulled his hand away. I think you have the wrong son, he said. It was Mrs. Richardson's turn to be taken aback.
There's nothing between Pearl and me.
It wasn't mine, he laughed, a tight, bitter cough.
Why don't you go ask Tripp? He's the one screwing her.
With one hand, he took the notebook from his mother's lap and opened it again, focusing on his own handwriting on the page to keep tears from escaping. It was true for him now, in a way it hadn't been before. She had been with Tripp. He had made love to her, and she had let him, and this had happened. Mrs. Richardson, however, didn't notice. She rose in a daze and headed down the hall to her own room to think things over. Tripp? She thought. Could that be? Neither she nor Moody was aware of the sudden quiet from Izzy's room, that Izzy's door was now open a crack, that Izzy, too, was sitting in stunned silence, absorbing what she'd heard. Mrs. Richardson went to work early on Friday morning, leaving a half hour early to avoid facing any of her children. The night before, Alexia had come home close to midnight, Tripp even later, and though normally she'd have scolded them for being out late on a school night, she had instead stayed in her room, ignoring their attempts to be stealthy on the stairs. She was trying to make sense of it all. Due to the extra stress, she had allowed herself a second glass of wine, which had gone warm. Tripp and Pearl? She understood, of course, why Pearl would fall for Tripp. Girls generally did. But what Tripp might see in Pearl was another matter. She fell asleep puzzling over it, and woke no more illuminated. He was not, she reflected as she backed out of the garage, the kind of boy who usually fell for serious, intellectual girls like Pearl. She could admit this, even as his mother, even as she adored him. He had always been about surface, her beautiful, sunny, shallow boy, and on the surface she couldn't see what would draw him to Pearl. So did Pearl have hidden depths? Or did Tripp? This thought preoccupied her all the way into her office. All morning she thought about what to do. Confront Tripp? Confront Pearl? Confront them both together? She and her husband did not speak to the children about their love lives. She'd had a talk with Lexi and Izzy when their periods had started, about their responsibilities. Vulnerabilities, Izzy had corrected her and left the room. But in general, she preferred to assume that her children were smart enough to make their own decisions, that the school had armed them well with knowledge. If they were up to things, as she euphemistically thought of it, she didn't need or want to know. To stand in front of Tripp and that girl and say to them, I know what you've been doing. That seemed as mortifying as stripping them both naked. At last, midway through the morning, she found herself getting into her car and driving to the little house on